Will old testament philosophy. The teacher today is a clean water block. I would have thought it was a monarch or a viceroy, but I'm looking on the internet, it's a clean water block. Today's lesson will be the first Samuel 1. We're talking about his mom. So the whole court, when the write-up is in our gospel, we know it says, as the final judge and one of the earliest war prophets, Samuel was present.
Most of the major historical events of his lifetime, from his boyhood growing up under the influence of Eli, to his involvement in the formation of a kingdom with Saul as the first king of God's people. Few things of importance occurred without his knowledge or participation. A study of Samuel as judge and prophet provides ancient lessons with modern meanings. So, as we install the clock so we know how long we're teaching today, but we're going to talk about stuff that's 4,000 years old. So, anyway, time is always just there. Can you name some people from the Bible who had positive influence from godly parents? Let's start out with that. Who can you name from the Bible who had a positive influence from godly parents or parent?
Moses.
Yeah, his mom.
Yep.
She saw to his safety, and then she even got a hand in it to raise him. And then he says he remembered his countrymen. He remembered the Hebrews. So, yeah, and that's from what she taught him.
Timothy in the New Testament.
It talks about his mom and his grandmother. Is it Lois and Eunice? Is that right?
Yep.
Okay. Lois is his grandmother? I think Eunice is his mom and Lois is his grandmother. My grandma's name was Lois, so I think I got that right. Either that or I get them backwards, one or the other.
Well, Jesus had to have a lot of influence from his parents, too.
He did. Jesus had to have a lot of influence from both parents, not just his mom, but his dad, too. He's known as the carpenter's son. He had to have a lot of influence by them. He knew how it worked in the synagogue, the temple. So he was around that. So he had some kind of influence. John the Baptist. Yeah, I mean, earlier on. Does he have, John the Baptist had the Nazarite oath, I'm assuming. Did he take the Nazarite oath?
John the Baptist was.
He was a Nazarite?
Right.
Okay.
Would Esther be?
I would think he is, but I'm not 100%. I should have looked it up, it kind of ties in with today's lesson, but yeah, there's a guy who lives in the wilderness and eats honey and locusts and so who else?
Would you consider Esther in there? Well, not his parents, but his uncle.
Esther and the influence of her uncle? Yeah, why not? Why not, right? Sometimes we have influence on somebody who's not just our own son or daughter. Maybe it comes from the influence from a grandmother, like Timothy. Maybe it comes from an outside relative. That's a good point. I'd say Esther. Yeah. Anybody else?
Isaac, Jacob, Joseph.
Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. You take Joseph to get through some of the trials he had to know God to get through what he got through.
Well, if you think about it, you look at it as a family line that all the parents did, because that's why it went through that family.
That's true. It flowed down to a family line, so all the parents did that to some degree. Yeah, for there to be anything left, a lot of this was oral tradition, long before it was written down, and even when it was written down, not everybody could read it. What it took to be at least a Jewish boy, I won't say girl, but I might be wrong on that, but didn't they have to memorize the first five books? Didn't they have to memorize the Pentateuch? I think so, but I'm not sure. So if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I'll take credit for that one. But anyways, but yeah, that takes a lot of effort, a lot of work. At least they were knowledgeable in it. If it was, you know, at least beyond that. It takes a lot of work.
I guess everybody got it. But what I'm saying is that's the way God planned it, influenced it, because of through that line. It's like a vine of branches.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a vine. It's a branch. You influence your family, you're with them. You should be with them more than you're with other people. not always the case when you're working and stuff, but those should be the people you have the most influence on, and it should flow down through that way. Last week I was in the teenage class, something Matt said kind of hit me was why, you know, one of the reasons some of those kids are Christians today is because of the influence of their parents, not just the fact that they brought them to church, but they probably haven't even looked at another God. They've never even considered the fact that they're might, you know, they've never looked at the other ones to say, hey, maybe I'll go this direction. This is the direction they've always just considered. It's a yes or no, but it hasn't been a multiple choice that they might consider because of the influence of their parents. What influence have your parents had on your life as a Christian? No, you can't expect your parents to be perfect. So trying to do the right thing, setting the right standards.
Right.
That's a good point. My work ethic comes from my parents. I still work with them. They're 73 and they still work overtime. My work ethic still comes from them. My exposure to Christ and God comes from when we were kids, mom took us to church. Actually, mom and dad together. My grandparents were both Bible teachers in the Baptist church, so I mean that's something that's flowed through our, you know, that lineage. I mean, whatever what I picked up started from that. Anybody else got anything? How your parents influenced you to be a Christian today?
Well, I was sitting here thinking about who was most influential in my spiritual life, and it was my father-in-law.
Okay, your father-in-law is the most spiritual influence in your life. That's cool. That's really cool.
Actually, Doug, you can see the lack of this in the results of it.
You can definitely
see the culture around you.
The culture around you, you're right. The lack of it, you can see the results. You can see the world, you can see where the world pulls away from God. The persecution of Christ that happens today, it's always happened, but you can definitely see that too. With the deterioration of the family, the deterioration of that effect on one another. You know, I'm going to throw my father-in-law in there too. What little I knew the guy, but what I know about him, it's like you know a tree by the fruit it bears. What I know about Howard McCaskill comes through Camille and her sister and brother. And the influence that he continues to have, even though he's passed away. You know, it's so... I'll give you that too. That's a little bit. All right. In Acts 13, verses 18 through 20, and for about 40 years he put up with them in the wilderness. And after destroying seven nations in the land of Canaan, he gave them their land as an inheritance. All this took about 450 years. After that, he gave them judges until Samuel the prophet. So this is Paul kind of recanting the history of Israel. So where does Samuel fit in the timeline of the Bible? It's kind of weird that we look in Acts to figure that out, but it kind of condenses things. Where does Samuel fit in the timeline of the Bible?
He was the last judge, and then comes the kings.
Yeah, he was the last judge just before the kings. Yeah. So you got the 40 years in the wilderness, after they were released from Egypt, they wandered for 40 years. They come into Canaan, they take it, and they possess it. And then the time of the judges. So it's about 450 years. I guess after the possession of Canaan till the time of the judges, or the time of Samuel, it's about 450 years. In Judges 21:25, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So describe life in Israel. I look back at my notes. I actually pulled the next slide from when we taught Judges in here. Chuck, you remember how long ago it was we taught Judges?
No, it seems like it was not that long ago, but I thought it was a few years.
2010. Yeah, I was like with you. It didn't seem all that long ago. It was 2010 that we taught Judges in here. It was a good study, but anyway. So, what was life like in Israel in the time of the Judges?
Well,
I think he tells you right there, everybody's doing what's right in their own eyes, so there's no right and wrong. It's up to the person.
It's up to
what you see going on now. It's in the name of tolerance.
Yeah. I do what's right in my eyes, and if you tell me it's wrong, you're wrong.
You have no right to say that.
Right. You have no right. I'm doing what's right in my own eye. This is the theme for the Book of Judges. It really is. It's what, well, you can kind of see a circle, and I really ought to draw this as a circle, but Israelites, they turn to false gods. Things are going good, really, and then they'll turn to false gods. God allows the enemies to come in and overrun Israel. Then they say, you know, things were a lot better when God was in control and asked for deliverance. So he sends a judge. Judge gives, is given a victory over the neighbors. Israel has a period of rest, and then the circle starts over. This is a common thing through judges. Well,
you know, one of the things you might remember also, you know, God was their lawgiver.
Mm-hmm.
And to a great extent, he was the law enforcer. But as far as the nations were concerned, there was no leader, as we have a president who is quote unquote our leader. We follow after the laws of a man,
mm-hmm.
but this was not God's desire. God's desire was for man to follow after his law, and everything would be good.
Follow after his law, follow after his lead, and things will be good. I am the Lord your God, and the rest just flows from there. You're right, he was the leader. There was no king, there was no president. They had elders, they had men influenced by God, but they didn't have a guy to either turn to or to blame, as the case may be. It was just God.
I'm reading Jeremiah right now, and it covers the ups and downs of the Jewish people,
the
nation of Israel, and how that God warned them with a spokesman, you know. Said, don't do this, you keep doing this, you're going to be destroyed. And eventually that happened by the Babylonians coming in and destroying Israel.
You get plenty of warnings.
Yep.
Yeah.
Thus saith the Lord.
They come into Canaan, and the description of Canaan is that the land is vomiting out Canaanites. They've been so filthy that the land itself is vomiting them out. And God gives them the victory in Canaan. And when you look through Joshua, it's like time after time after time. It's just, if God does the work, and they take possession, they don't get rid of all the natives, but it is a great victory. I mean, now, back here in Acts 13, the history that passed down through the families, history that passed down through God's word, they came out of exile, and they came out of slavery in Egypt. They came through the 10 plagues. They came through the Red Sea. They survived in the wilderness. They were given a land. They were given a victory over that land. This is passed down. We still got it. You pick up the Bible of Funny, and it's right there. It's all recorded. But then they took charge of their own stuff, and things fell to pieces. And these circles, as you go through Judges, these circles start out relatively small. Some of the times the judges are 30 years, 40 years. Does that sound about right?
Some are a year.
Year. You know, we can tolerate a year, maybe. Yeah, a year would still be bad. Look what we're facing with ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And who knows what else. A year would be bad. 30 years would be terrible. It gets to be longer than that. The circle gets bigger and bigger. Until the 10 tribes get overtaken by the Assyrians and disappear. Then the 2 tribes get taken over by the Babylonians, and they kind of leave the land kind of vacant. You know, kind of looks like the Miracle City Mall or so.
Well, you've got to ask yourself, does this apply to us? Of course it does. That's why he wrote it down for us to read.
Sure. It definitely applies to our own life. Bad things will still happen to us. Unfortunately, but you're right. You're in the middle of it. But things will go smoother in the long run. The hope's only there in Christ. All right. So anyways, that's kind of the background for it. So 1 Samuel 1, 1 through 2. There was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim. I'm glad I didn't go to that high school. Of the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, son of Elihu, son of Tohu, son of Zuth, an Ephrathite. He had two wives. The name of one was Hannah. The other name was Hanina. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. All right, I'm going to sum that up. You don't even have to say the Hebrew names. So, since I butchered them enough for all of them.
Sounds like Chinese restaurants.
It, doesn't it? That's why he has points. Say, I want number 44. So, yeah. I'm going to summarize what we're starting out with. There's some dude now named Elkanah, and he had what?
Two wives.
All right, Hannah and Peninnah.
And he had some children.
And Peninnah had kids. Hannah ain't got no kids. Well, Elkanah is a grandfather by one wife. He's a father by one wife. He's not by the other wife.
The key to this is you can't take credit because Hannah was barren, but she had a child.
That's where we're going. So yeah, that really gets that way. That's where we're going with this lesson. Verse 3, now this man used to go up year by year from his city to worship and sacrifice the Lord of hosts at Shiloh, where the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests of the Lord. So what was different about Elkanah? When you compare back to Judges 21, where everybody did what they thought was right, there wasn't no king, and he was just going to do what we want to do. What was different about Elkanah?
The same thing was different about Noah and Lot.
Yeah, you're right. Same thing that was different about Noah, same thing that was different about Lot. Everything else in the world was going on, but not in their house. They were faithful to God, although the world was going their own way all around. That's a good point. Where did they go to worship and sacrifice? Where did they go to worship and sacrifice?
They went to Shiloh. That's where the tabernacle was set up after, you know, they settled down.
That's it. That's where the tabernacle was set up when they finally settled down, after they stopped fighting wars. This is where they divided the land, I think. Shiloh was it. Before Jerusalem became the center of worship, like I said, that's where the tabernacle was. That's the place, Shiloh. You would think Shiloh would appear on more Old Testament maps. I looked at a dozen of them, couldn't find Shiloh anywhere. So I will guarantee it is not on US 1 across from Ace Hardware. Other than that, who knows where? It's somewhere. I'm sure if I looked for long enough, I could have found a map, but it's probably not of any value for any of us. But anyways. So in 1 Samuel 1:9, after they had eaten and drunk at Shiloh, Hannah rose. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat beside the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. And in 4:18, as soon as he mentioned the ark of God, Eli fell over backward from his seat by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died. The man was old and heavy. He had judged Israel 40 years. The question is, who is Eli?
He was a bad judge. He was overweight, too.
He was a bad, overweight judge. Okay? Yeah. I want to say none of the judges were bad. You'll find things where his judgment of God's...
And he didn't take care of his sons, remember?
Right. You're right. Now I'll get to that part, too. But you're right. Clayton ought to teach this guy. So anyways, yeah, he's a judge, but he's got some issues too, and his sons, we'll get to that. So he's a judge, what else?
He's a priest.
He seems to be...
It almost sounds like a high priest.
It sounds like he's probably the high priest, is kind of what it does, because he's the guy at the door of the temple.
He's at taking advantage of the situation. He's getting too fat on.
Yeah, you know, that's absolutely right. He's getting too fat on the situation. If you jump forward a chapter in 1 Samuel 2, 12 through 14, now the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord. The custom of the priests with the people was that when any man offered sacrifice, the priest's servant would come while the meat was boiling with a three-pronged fork in his hand, and he would thrust it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot. All that the fork brought up, the priest would take for himself. This is what I did at Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. So yeah, Clayton's right. He's getting fat on the chow. Hey, you brought that for sacrifice? That looks good. Throw some potatoes in there with it. Yeah. Stick the fork in there. Whatever comes up is mine. God can keep the rest. There's an old joke about the preacher that does that with the collection plate. Throws it up, anything God catches is his, and the rest belongs to the preacher. So, anyways, it doesn't happen here. Anyways, he's getting fat off that. Everybody brings a sacrifice. He's got a good fork. You know, is the three prongs flat? Man, I'm taking a piece of it. I'm going to make my three prongs kind of like out of the way. Get a good sharp on there, and you pull out half of that thing, you know? Make sure you get plenty. But he's getting fat on the job. So what's Eli often remembered for? Clayton kind of said it earlier, but although he was a judge and a priest, what's he kind of remembered for?
The only thing I remember is he fell over backwards and broke his neck.
Okay. He fell over backwards and broke his neck. Getting fat on the job. You mentioned his sons earlier.
His sons weren't. He didn't take care of it. He didn't discipline his sons.
Yeah.
He was a man of prayer.
He's a man of prayer. He ends up, as we'll get into it, he teaches Samuel. But sometimes it's forgotten. Sometimes what people remember is his sons were worthless. I mean, the Bible says they're worthless. That's pretty harsh. Like 4,000 or so years later, these two guys are remembered as being worthless. That's not what you want next to your name. You know, for a long time. Worthless. More on his sons, 1 Samuel 2:22-25. Now Eli was very old. He kept hearing all that his sons were doing to all of Israel, and how they lay with women who were serving at the entrance of the tent of meeting. And he said to them, "Why do you do such things? If I hear of your evil doings from all these people, know, my sons, it is no good report that I hear the people of the Lord spreading abroad. If someone sins against a man, God will mediate for him. If someone sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him? They would not listen to the voice of their father. It was the will of the Lord to put them to death." So anyways, these guys were pretty worthless. But and sometimes that's what we remember about Eli. So back to 1 Samuel 1, 4 through 5. On the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah, he gave a double portion because he loved her. So the Lord had closed her womb. So tell me about Hannah.
She's quite ashamed because of being barren.
Okay.
But she actually had a good dad that cared about them.
Her husband. That's her husband.
Oh, okay, her husband.
That's all right. I said grandfather earlier, so I goofed that one up too.
I think she was spoiled.
Say it again?
I think she's spoiled.
She's spoiled? She could be that too. He definitely showed her love to her by giving her double.
He loved her more.
He spoiled her.
That's what husbands do, they love their wives.
You know what? That's really, it's true.
She's not even here.
She's not even here, and he says that. Chuck?
It looks like the Lieutenant of the event.
Yeah.
But he gave from that standpoint, but quite a different standpoint when you're talking about Hannah.
Yeah, and that might be what the double portion is. He gives one because she's due that, and the other one out of love. Here's more. Give it to. If you got your own Bible, you might have a little star next to this verse. Okay? If you go down to the bottom of the page, it says the Septuagint says, "And although he loved Hannah, he would give Hannah only one portion because the Lord had closed her womb." So, you know, if you go by the star version from the Septuagint, it would kind of say he would like to have given her a second portion rather than he actually did. But that's fine, too. Either way, one of this shrugs her shoulders. She don't care. He loved her, and that it shows. Whether it's in his mind or in his actions, it shows how much he loved her. So 6 and 7, "And her rival used to provoke her grievously to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. So it went on year by year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. Therefore Hannah wept and would not eat." So how was the relationship between Peninnah and Hannah?
Pretty
kind of the same it was between that guy and Sarah.
Yeah.
I have children, you know, I'm better than you. What's wrong with you? You must have done something wrong. How come you can't have any children? I've got all these children. You're not a good wife. I mean, it's probably on and on and on.
Yeah, you did. And you can almost see back when we just saw with Elkanah and her, I mean, I looked at it as like, it's Jacob and Rebekah. He has four wives, and he has children by the other three before he ever has children with her. And but he loved her very, very much. He finally has 13 kids. But anyway, but yeah, so this is the same kind of thing. There's this, she's getting irritated by the one who has kids. And it doesn't just happen. It happens, it says, year after year after year. Where does it happen? Happens worse at the temple. That's just kind of a weird place. It doesn't say it happens back at the house, back on the farm. It happens every year, and they go down to Shiloh, and she irritates her with it. Verse 8, and Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? Why is your heart sad? Am I not more to you than 10 sons? So is he showing his love, or is he rubbing it in? There's probably no good answer to this.
You can tell he feels a little jealous because she's more concerned about a son she doesn't have than her own husband. He's probably got his feelings hurt a little bit.
Probably so. He shows his love. She don't see it
but
that
he
way.
He actually likes her a lot.
Yeah. She doesn't necessarily see it that way, and he doesn't hold it against her if she doesn't have any kids. So, yeah. It could be.
Put the crying. He's on. I'm tired of this crying about that. I love you. I love you. Get over it.
Get over it. You're killing yourself here. It could be. It could be. It's one of these situations that everybody will see it differently based on their own, where they've been in life. And I'm going to bet Elkanah's side of this story is different than Hannah's side of the story. And it's the same sentences. But the story's a little bit different. But it's still, it's the same thing. But he cares for her that much that, like you said, don't weep. Eat. Verse 9 through 11. After they'd eaten and drunk in Shiloh, Hannah rose. Now Eli the priest was sitting on a seat beside the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. She was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. And she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant, remember me, not forgive your servant, but will give to your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head. What does Hannah do? Year after year being tormented, picked on. After she gets to the point that Elkanah says, I love you, you need to eat. What does she do about it? She prays. She goes down to the temple and prays.
Makes a vow.
Say it again.
She makes a vow to the Lord.
She does make a vow to the Lord. Yeah, that's part of her prayer. I want you to give me a son. Not just a baby. I want you to give me a son.
Well, that actually says a lot about Hannah. Because remember, this is a time when everybody's doing what's right in their own lives, right?
Yeah, everybody's doing what's right in their own lives. She
is trying to do the right thing.
She's trying
to
do
the right thing.
And something she does even different than that. Not only just give me a baby. Don't give me a. Doesn't ask for a baby that's better than Penina's babies. One is loved by daddy more than the rest. She asks for one that's dedicated to God. She says, I'll make that vow right now. I'll give him to you all the days of his life. And as we know, what we know about Samuel is he's given to God for all the days of his life. That's not a kid that's going to be sticking around the farm and milking goats, you know. That's not his job. He's going to be given to God. A son that she always wanted, she'll end up giving him to God.
I'd think it's also, you know, look at this, she didn't ask for a child, she asked for a son.
Yeah.
So that the lineage could pass on through him. And that was very important to a Jewish woman.
It is, it's very important to a Jewish woman. Like I said, a lineage passed down. The sons were just that valued. I won't say they're not that valued today. You know, I've got one of each. I love them both. Sons are still, like I say, that's where the name goes. You know, the names typically go with the sons. Not always, but name goes with the son. I have 24 first cousins. I think I get 18 on dad's side. But I'm the only one who has a son. So I'm the only one who has a son named Hunter. So I'm the only one of all them who passes the name. For whatever that's worth. But anyways. So it's not selfish motivation that she wants a baby. It doesn't say, so I got something to brag about, so I got something to shut her up. She wants it for God. David Toshio Sumura, out of his commentary on Samuel, usually a woman who had suffered so from not having a child would not give him up once he was born. But Hannah, a dedicated woman, was willing. Compare Abraham in Genesis 22. Here Hannah promised and gave. There Abraham was promised and was ordered to give. But both acted on faith. But you bring it in light in terms of Abraham, where he was promised a son, promised a son, promised a son. And at 100, he has a son. But then he's asked to sacrifice that son. Hannah's not asked to sacrifice a son, but she is, but she willingly gives him to God in God's service. So that's the promise and that faithful act are both, you know, very similar in the two of them. Very, very similar.
That would be hard to do for a woman, especially giving a child up at that young age.
I would think so. I definitely would think so. My kids are a little older and I'd still have a hard time giving them up for very long.
Doug, you didn't even say it's similar to Solomon when that two ladies were fighting over the kid. He said split them in half.
Yeah, split them in half. And the real mama said, no, just let him live with her.
It's the same thing.
It is. That bind that we have with our own kids, the next time you see somebody's going to be put to death, some kind of death penalty execution, watch the news story. Mama will be there. She'll be standing there. She'll be there. That's just always how it is. Some kid who's gone so bad that he's killed people, whether it's 1 or 10, but mama will still be there, that lack, hoping for something. But that's just how it is with kids. It should be with kids. But that way, it should be that way with kids. It's not always that way, but it should be that way with kids. So what's the deal with no razor shall touch his head? It is Sam. Reminds you of Samson?
Samson.
Yeah. I was going for this look. I was going to work on that for next year's trunk or treat. Camille refused to let me do that. And Taylor's getting married. She's like, whatever makes you happy. I was like, can I get the beard down here? She's like, whatever makes you happy. Yeah. Samson's a good one. There's a good example of somebody who no razor shall touch his head. John the Baptist. The woolly man that he had to be. See this, what it is a Nazirite vow. Numbers 6, verses 1 through 4, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when neither a man or a woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazirite, to separate himself to the Lord, he shall separate himself from wine and strong drink. He shall drink no vinegar made from wine or strong drink, and shall not drink any juice of grapes or eat grapes, fresh or dry. All the days of his separation he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine, not even the seeds or the skins. This is just first part of it. Well, what does the Nazirite vow signify?
Dedication.
It's dedication, yeah. Okay, they've set themselves apart for the Lord. What do you think that means? I didn't look this up. I mean, what do you think that would entail? You set yourself aside for the Lord. Stop cutting your hair. Stop shaving. that an hour or two a week? 3 minutes and 45 seconds it takes to read a Bible chapter each day?
That's a lifetime.
A lifetime? Or at least, yes. In Samuel's case, it's a lifetime.
Well, John the Baptist would have been a lifetime.
In John the Baptist's case, it's a lifetime. In Samson's case, it's a lifetime. It's a little different with the Nazarite oath. If you go to verse 5, all the days of this vow of separation, no razor shall touch his head, till the time is completed for which he separates himself to the Lord, he shall be whole. He shall let the locks of his hair. So it's got this thing, and as you get into this chapter, there's a sacrifice that's done when the oath is done. So it's for a period of time that you can do this oath. But those, you know, they're dedicated to it for a lifetime. So, yeah, so what do you think it means to be separated for the Lord? What do you do during that time? I didn't look this up in anybody's commentary or anything. It's just a question that hit me. What would you do if you're separated from the Lord Jesus? Whatever he wants you to do is probably.
What he wants you to do.
That's probably a good answer, really. And that's really what you see.
Kind of like being in a National Guard or something, you know.
In the Samuel that says, "Here I am, Lord. Use me." You know. Whatever he wants him to do. Samson's the same way.
You would think they would live at a separate place, to be kind of like the fire department, to be on standby.
Yeah, doing God's work in some form or fashion. Whatever, like I say, whatever that might be. But back up, is it voluntary or mandated? Another question on there, is it men or women?
Either one.
It could be either one. It could be either one, man or women. Is it voluntary? Or is it something that's kind of stuck on somebody?
Well, I don't think he had a choice when his mom went there.
Samuel doesn't have a choice, you're right.
So I would say mandated, but it wasn't voluntary. But on the other hand, he would have to volunteer because he could have took off later when he was older. So it's kind of both.
You're probably right. He still has that.
He had the right heart.
He has that right that he could probably walk away from it at any given point.
Now, we know with Samson, he kind of messed up a few times.
Yeah. This talks about when either a man or a woman makes a special vow. So they've chosen this vow. But like I say, with Samuel, it's just a little different. It's something that mama makes for him.
You could almost say it's mandated with a free will.
That's tricky right there. That's tricky. But it is a lot like our Christianity. It's our choice. You know, it's our choice to enter into that.
Well, yeah, he could have took off. If not, it would have been fair.
He could take off. You're right. You're absolutely right. Mama stuck him into that contract, and he could have walked off at any given time.
She made the vow.
Yeah, he didn't do it. He didn't choose it.
If he had made the vow, voluntary.
Yeah. So it's in this point, in his case, it's stuck on him. Anyways, there's a bunch of stuff with that. 1 Samuel 1:9-11. After I had eaten and drunk in Shiloh, well, we already read that. The vow Hannah makes for her son is basically the Nazarite vow. In 12-14, as she continued praying before the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was speaking in her heart, only her lips moved, and her voice was not heard. Therefore, Eli took her to be a drunken woman, and Eli said to her, "How long will you go on being drunk? Put your wine away from you." What did Eli see?
Well, you know, that says something. That tells me a lot of women are drunk.
Oh.
Well, if you...
Just because her lips are moving and you ain't listening, that means she ain't saying something, Clayton.
Yeah, your ears shut up.
But for whatever reasons. But yeah. Apparently that's something he's used to seeing.
This is a guy that doesn't even see his own sons doing stuff. He's quick to jump on her. What are you, drunk? Come down here to the temple. He doesn't see anything his sons are doing right under his own nose. Anybody listening to the Serial podcast? Kirk is. I know Kirk is. It's on, what's his name, Bergdahl?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bo Bergdahl.
Sorry, I had his first name wrong. But one of the things, he's in captivity with the Taliban, and that the questions they ask him are like, where does the army get their prostitutes and their alcohol, and are you all drunks and stuff? And I just, when I saw this, it's almost the same thing. There's no rationale for asking her why she's drunk, but that just seems to be the thing. Hey, you must be drunk. So. We saw that anyways. But Hannah answered, "No, my Lord, I am a woman troubled in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I've been pouring out my soul before the Lord. Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman, for all along I've been speaking out of my great anxiety and vexation." So she's not drunk. She's praying. She's pouring her heart out to God. She's troubled in spirit. Verse 17, and Eli answered, "Go in peace, and with God of Israel grant your petition that you have made to him." She said, "Let your servant find favor in your eyes." And the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. He accuses her of all kinds of stuff, being drunk and disrespectful to God, but he doesn't apologize, but he sends her on her way. Verse 19, they rose early in the morning and worshiped before the Lord. Then they went back to their house at Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah, his wife, and the Lord remembered her. And in due time, Hannah conceived and bore a son. She called his name Samuel, for she said, "I have asked for him from the Lord." Was the baby from natural causes or God's providence? God intervened. You're right. It's a natural occurrence. It's not like Jesus coming from Mary. But her womb was closed for a lot of time, long time. You know, this isn't the first time that's happened. It's just God intervened. It's his providence. He provides. Samuel's name means God has heard. Verse 21, the man named Elkanah and all his house went up to the Lord to yearly sacrifice and to pay his vow. But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, "As soon as the child is weaned, I will bring him so that he may appear in the presence of the Lord and dwell with him forever." So when they go each year to make the sacrifice, next time they go, Hannah don't go. Keep Samuel at home. She's not going to go until she can just drop him off and leave him there. So after he's weaned, I don't know how long it is. 2, 1, I don't know, 6. Some people stand. It probably says, whoever Chuck's got the next lesson, it probably says how old he is. But I don't care if he's 12. You know, it'd be tough to walk up with a 12-year-old and say, "He's yours. Take care of him. He's God's."
I think it indicated somewhere that he was 3 years old.
I think he's 3-2. I didn't look, but I think
that's
he's...
That's 3 years old. You don't wait 3 years to win him.
You don't?
But,
no. No, not typically. You're right. 3 years is a long time. Was she...
Well, back then they didn't have Pavlov.
Well,
no, they didn't have Pavlov, didn't have formula. Anyways... God's providence, she gives him to God. And that's the beginning of Samuel. And that's kind of real. It's godly parents and got him in that place. It's God's providence that he was born. God uses from there. So next week, we're going to look at the boy Samuel. 1 Samuel 1, 24 through 28, 2, 18 through 21, 3, 1 through 4. Chuck's teaching that, right? So we're looking at Samuel next week. So thank you all.